Welcome back to the Mediocre Movie Club podcast. I'm John Kissel, and with me tonight is Shane Settner.
Yo!
And J.R. Peters.
Howdy.
Say that again.
Howdy.
Better. A little Skype creaky.
We're off in the Midwest here. I like that that I say yo, and J.R. says howdy here, so...
And not well either. It might be Skype, but howdy. it could just be delivery. Who knows?
Howdy, JR. Would you like some unseasoned chicken?
Throw some ranch on that bitch, and I'm all in.
Here at the Media Movie Club, we select three movies over the course of a month. We discuss them and write reviews on MediaComovie.club, and then we get together at the end of the month to record a podcast about said three movies. This last month, we selected Selma and Juice and Da 5 Bloods. We're going to start with Selma. This is a movie from 2014, directed by Ava DuVernay, about Martin Luther King Jr.'s voting rights drive in Selma and the march across the Evan Pettus Bridge and the push for the Voting Rights Act in 1965. This was described as a biopic. And framed as a biopic, high-profile historical figure, high-profile movie, and this is like the ideal biopic format. It's not about the broad scope of MLK's life. You don't see him as a child getting called the N-word by someone in Atlanta, where I think he grew up, right? That's where MLK grew up, right?
I was listening.
Okay, fair enough.
I didn't watch this.
Shane didn't watch this.
I've never heard of MLK.
His life framed through a single incident in his life, a single period, which is just, it avoids all the walk hard-esque cliches of the biopic genre. JR, what'd you think of Selma?
I mean, it's a good movie. My only problem with it, and as I said when we chose it, was it's easy. Basically everyone already knows what's happening here. It's not like you need to bring any new information. You know, maybe you don't know that about COINTELPRO and that the FBI are listening in on him. But like you know everything that's happening here. They did it well, to be fair.
That being said, there are not that many representations of MLK on screen. I can think of an HBO movie about the Montgomery bus boycott that aired in like the early 20th century or 21st century in like the early 2000s. And that's kind of all I got.
It is my boss didn't believe me that MLK Day was a federal holiday. I'm like, yes, it's a federal fucking
Which boss? Not
current boss.
No, we didn't.
He did not think it was a federal holiday. I was like, it is a federal holiday. He's like, it is not. I'm like, yes, it is.
Oh. I could believe that somebody wouldn't know that.
Yeah, would you believe that someone who grew up in the suburbs in Georgia?
There's a pretty lengthy like national debate about it within his lifetime.
Sure.
In the suburbs of Georgia in his lifetime, they were still cursing him. Yeah. Talking about that dirty nigra.
Anyways, back to Selma.
It is gotta be a challenge to play someone like MLK, right? Because I think it's really hard to write a character like that is so revered, who obviously has some faults because he is a dude. How do you do that? Like how do you make him seem like a person in film?
I think Selma does, and I love this movie. I think this is a great movie. I think this is a great example of a biopic. I think it's a great representation of this period of history. I think it's a great representation of a man who increasingly is just becoming more and more abstract to the American public. So how do you portray this guy, and how do you make him not a saint? You just tell the truth. He was not a faithful man to his wife, and we know this kind of stuff because of grotesque federal overreach in the way that the FBI was like bugging various hotel rooms. But you know, they did send his wife tapes of him with other women, and that's in the movie. And they have discussions about it. Him and his wife, him and Martin Luther King is played by David Oyelowo, and his wife Coretta is played by Carmen Ejogo. and like that's included in a movie that doesn't have to include it necessarily.
I obviously haven't seen it. So, Jay, you say this is a lazy movie, I guess?
No. I'm saying it's easy.
It's easy. It's
a very easy movie. Yeah. Like,
yeah.
I don't know.
For background, yeah, we decided as a group that we were going to discuss African-American themed movies for this latest round. And Selma was, you know, up for nomination, as well as several just more obscure movies that most people probably hadn't seen. So, as opposed to Selma, which was like nominated for an Academy, like for Best Picture, and was like a major hit.
Not only that, but it's just like a straightforward. It's just pretty fucking straightforward. Like you're sitting down, you're just gonna watch it.
But I do want to push back on Selma as like a simplistic movie, because I do think it is pitched to a broader audience, but I think by portraying these like secular American heroes as full people is always a valuable lesson. And also there's a shrewdness and a realpolitik aspect to it that it's a thread present in like every historical American push towards social justice that gets like washed away over the course of history. Like Rosa Parks, you know, wasn't actually a tired middle-aged lady going home from her secretary job. She was like a longtime activist who was placed in a spot on purpose. And here,
yeah, I'm pretty sure she's one of the good ones, John.
And like, And how that manifests here is that I think it's Ralph Abernathy, the actor whose name I don't know off the top of my head, who was like MLK's close confidant and a second in the Southern, the SCLC. Selma wasn't selected because there was some unique brand of injustice there. It was selected because they happened to have a bloodthirsty sheriff who was going to beat the shit out of them, and therefore generate a lot of publicity and a lot of sympathy in the media. Like and that speech is framed within the context of them coming off of a failure, a failed campaign where the sheriff was not bloodthirsty. He would just let them march, didn't break out the batons and the police dogs and the cavalry, and nothing happened. There's like a twisted level of not culpability, but like, when people start getting beaten and when people start getting murdered, like they're in the right place, not only because there is this injustice happening, but they're in the right place because this is going to be a better sale. And all that is true and correct. Like there are like human sacrifices in a way in this movie on the way towards greater justice. And I think a less complicated movie, a more simplistic movie, wouldn't even entertain any of that. Did that come across at all to you, JR?
I guess it's just hard watching it for me because I already know. Like, there's nothing new in this for me, I guess. And so then it just seems simplistic to me because growing up as a black person with, like, a family that knows all this stuff, you know, I'm just like, yeah, this is what it is. There's nothing. Like, we knew this.
Is it kind of sad that John and I live in Atlanta and we know, like, of Ralph Abernathy, the road, and we know of John Lewis, but
we know of Hosea Williams.
We know Hosea Williams, but we don't know any of this story at all. And so this is a challenge.
Hang on.
I don't know any of it. I don't know any of this. I vaguely know about Selma.
The specific politics are new to it, and like the selection of these sites. When this movie came out in 2014, it was heavily compared to Lincoln. Not only in the way that it borrows from that biopic format where, you know, it's not about Lincoln's life, it's about Lincoln's pursuit of the 13th Amendment, but that movie also was very much about horse trading. Like, can I get people to vote for this amendment if I offer them a postal service patronage job? And this movie is also about, like, the sausage making of activism and of forcing politicians and policymakers and forcing their hands. Like, that aspect of it is fascinating. And again, like I was saying, like whatever makes heroes into humans, that's just permanently a valuable lesson, really, no matter who the hero is. it's just a valuable historical lesson. Like, they didn't live in a mythic time. They lived in their own time, which was not so terribly different from ours. They, you know, they went and hung out in for Sunday brunches and had people and you know, sat around the table and shot the shit. And they were people. They were human beings, and it wasn't all black and white morally, I mean.
Right.
It wasn't black and white in real life either. They took them damn pictures in color and they made them black and white to make it seem like it was older. Just so you know. There's some more trickery for you.
Yeah, it's fascinating. And like, there is some other stuff as far as like how many deaths were associated with Selma. Like Jimmy Lee Jackson, played by Lakeith Stanfield, and in the aftermath of the march, when people from the North, like religious leaders, religious clergy, and just other people that want to take part, are murdered in the immediate aftermath of the march, and the pop culture interpretation of, or the pop history interpretation of this event is that it happened. The Voting Rights Act was passed. Huzzah. Like, people drove home from the march and were pulled out of their cars by the Ku Klux Klan and murdered. You can see that the movie like starts to focus on those people, and you don't really have a sense of why. And then you figure out why. It's because they were killed in the course of this event. That was news to me. Something interesting about this movie is that they didn't license King's speeches. They had to just invent them. And I thought that was very well done. Like, he gives two speeches that if they had licensed them, they would have used the real ones. And it's pretty indistinguishable. And then also, I feel like the most fascinating part of his life is the part between this moment and his death, when he's going to go north and experience nothing but failure and hatred throughout the rest of the country, throughout a broad cross-section of the country, and not just the South. And the end of this movie kind of points towards it, like he's about to pivot. He's going to continue talking about racial justice, of course, but he's also going to start talking about like economic injustice in the Vietnam War, and that's included in that last speech. And like, those two things are just not something that anybody wants to hear about from him at this point in history. And I think it's just a great stroke by the movie to have that foresight to like include that at the final victory of his life. Like, this is the last triumph he's really going to have until he's assassinated. Anything? Anything on
no.
that jail?
Okay. No, nothing. Yeah. There's nothing to add to that one.
Okay. Great. Last thing about Selma, really well cast. Like, every actor under 30 in this movie is like within the next couple years, within the next 5 years is on their way to like major stardom. Stephen James plays John Lewis, and he eventually will, you know, go on to like If Beale Street Could Talk and Homecoming on Amazon. Andre Holland is in this. He's going to go on to The Nick and Moonlight and High Flying Bird. Tessa Thompson is in this, and Tessa Thompson and Lakeith Stanfield both are like in the midst of their breakout period, and they're going to soon be like stars in their own right. It's just, it's really impressive that they would find this young talent mixed in with more established actors like Oyelowo, like Wendell Pierce, who plays Hosea Williams, like Tom Wilkinson, who plays LBJ. It's just a really well cast movie. And good on David Oyelowo, apparently, for shaking the tree and getting all these people.
Apparently.
With people involved.
So I saw you put this on the thing, and there's like only one other movie I could think of. I was thinking about this. Like, one other movie that's done casting where everybody went on to be stars, like where all the young people. And it was the only one I could think of was Short Term 12, if you've seen that.
Yeah, Lakeith Stanfield also in that. And yeah, they just had incredible luck.
Yeah, Lakeith, who else was in it? Rami Malek, Brie Larson.
Anything Lakeith Stanfield touches, generally. He's not a major player in this movie, but it's not going to be bad.
There's a billboard around town with him on it, and it's not a movie I've heard of, so I assume it's probably not very good.
What's it called? You know?
I don't know. It's a white billboard. Yeah, I haven't seen He's like forehead to forehead with a pretty woman.
Oh, The Photograph?
Sure.
Black people love that movie. I know exactly. He's forehead to forehead with Issa Rae, I think.
Okay.
You know exactly why is that billboard? That movie came out in like February when people could it's still up
in
comedy. Okay. They don't do a great job of like swapping out the bus posters,
no.
Which generally tend to be like black themed media.
Yeah.
So yeah, maybe just hung around for a while.
Yeah.
Maybe that person got sick.
It's Atlanta. I don't know.
That's it on Selma.
Oh, I you guys want to hear my one time I met John Lewis?
Sure.
Yeah. At Burger King, and he stood in line behind me like a normal person, and was very polite and ordered two hamburgers with no mustard, and it was the sweetest thing I've ever seen. Because just John Lewis, hero of the fucking nation, and was so polite. Everyone's like, "Was that John Lewis?" I was like, "Yeah." And he just walked out with his burger.
Just two hamburgers, no mustard.
Two hamburgers, no mustard.
Okay. That's an idiosyncratic order.
Yeah, very specific.
Very.
Yeah.
I feel like no one orders just the hamburgers from any of those places.
I do.
Really?
Yeah. My usual order from Burger King is two hamburgers and one of their crispy chickens, no mayonnaise. Or like McDonald's, it's two hamburgers and McChicken no mayo.
Hey, you and John Lewis.
I got a double Whopper with cheese and bacon for dinner today. That was it.
JR and John Lewis. Everybody loves Burger King. This episode of the Munich Movie Club podcast sponsored by Burger King. Have it your way. The Burger King in. I'm going to blow our endorsement here. The Burger King in the suburb where I work turns their lights off at 10 p.m. despite the fact that they're supposedly open all night.
Yeah.
Very frustrating.
That's frustrating.
Yeah. And then they just don't answer the drive-thru.
Yeah. The Burger King I was at Old Fourth Ward, so your Burger King is evil.
It might be, yes. Great. The Wendy's drive-thru was just the line is into the street practically.
Yeah.
I feel like Burger King is really missing out on a lot.
I used to work at Subway in high school. People would show up at 8:59. We close at 9, and we would duck and hide.
Please. I mean, that makes sense. Yeah. Yes, our final fast food tale for this episode is when I managed an Arby's, I would shut down the shake machine with like 45 minutes to go before closing, just to get a jump on things.
Yeah.
And when people would order shakes, no.
There were nights
we're not doing that.
At Subway, I had everything in the cooler. There was nothing on that out the front.
And someone comes in at 9:59
or whatever. They could come inside. There's last hour drive through, but I would make everything in the cooler.
Anything to add, JR?
Yeah. fuck Arby's shakes anyway, because your shit comes out the same fucking tube, and so if I try to get a goddamn strawberry shake. Ends up tasting like a fucking Jamocha tip. Yeah, I'm like, what kind of bullshit is this, man? I wanted strawberry, not fucking coffee.
Generally pro Arby's, even after working there for a very long time in high school. But yes, I would never order shake from Arby's. We reuse the stuff. I don't know what you even call it. The mix. We use the mix more than we probably should have.
I don't give, listen, if I'm going to Arby's or McDonald's, I don't care about the health, okay? Obviously, I'm not in it to make myself live longer. I just want it to not taste like fucking coffee.
Yeah, a little mold? Great. A little coffee? Absolutely not.
Yeah, I like blue cheese. It's cool.
In my mind, Arby's still has that juice. Not so much for JR. Let's bring this into our next movie, Juice, directed by Ernest Dickerson. 1992.
That segue got the juice now.
This is his debut as a director. He is a longtime, or he's a classmate of Spike Lee, and he was a longtime cinematographer for Spike Lee. This is his first movie as a director, his first and only, which we'll talk about, movie as a writer. This is Tupac's debut as an actor. This is Omar Epps' first major role. get like a theoretically big breakout movie for a lot of people. What did we think of Juice around the horn? Shane, you did see this movie. Yes?
It was better than I remember, partner.
All right. JR, Juice?
Yeah, I probably gave it a B-, but I'm going to go with a B. I like it.
I thought it was a mess. I thought it was two movies that don't fit well together. And we're going to talk about that. I think one movie... Juice takes like 10 minutes in its opening to just establish the morning routines of its quartet of teen characters who are growing up in New York. 17, 18, give or take. Super endearing, charming. You get like character beats out of what they're doing, out of how they're ordering their days. And then it becomes like a psychopath monster movie where Tupac is like coming out of the shadows. And yeah. I just don't buy it. Like, we're introduced to Tupac like gently kissing his semi-comatose dad on the forehead.
Yeah.
And by the end, he is like hugging a mom of a kid whose son he murdered and selling just the pure psychopathy of being able to do that. So it just doesn't work. They just don't fit.
Oh, come on. That is crap. People are literal psychopaths. Every person is a psychopath. They just hide it. Okay.
JR, if you hear some rustling in the background, that's him strangling a kitten. You would never know.
I am inclined to agree with you. It's almost two movies, but I don't think it's...
I think both movies are good. Make no mistake.
Yeah.
I think the psychopath monster movie... I think Tupac is great in this movie. In both halves. It's just they don't make the transition.
I thought it was... It felt like to me... I was watching it, and I just listened to The Ringer's Stand By Me.
Mm-hmm.
Rewatchables. Rewatchables, yeah. Mm-hmm. So I was thinking about Stand By Me a lot. Like, the first... hour of this movie really feels like a lot of Stand By Me. And you talk about the Goonies where everyone's mean to Chunk. And I thought about that a lot as well, because these guys are all fucking with each other and it works so great. Like, there's such a legitimate high school male relationship.
I completely agree.
And then the last 30 minutes is a horror movie. But
yeah,
Tupac doesn't have any special powers other than being awesome as shit.
I feel like you can get there, but you just gotta do more work.
What work did you want? Like, the dude has flashes of being a crazy person the whole time.
The movie lays some amount of track. The key turn in the movie is Tupac going from, you know, one of a key member of this group of friends, this group of, you know, equals, to murdering one of them and attempting to murder the other. And there's some amount of track there laid with like his desire to like they pass an older kid who is about to rob a bar in broad daylight, and Tupac wants to join them and is thwarted by the other members of the group. But that decision, I mean, he's that decision just doesn't gel with his home life. His dad, who we learn has been in jail and has not done well in the aftermath, if any of the characters should understand that they want to stay away from that outcome, it would be him. But he's the most gung-ho.
Yeah.
So if he was more dragged into a bad situation as opposed to like diving in head first, I would buy it more. Like, if he accidentally killed his friend and felt bad about it and had this example at home of, like, I can't go to jail. I have to make this go away. I would buy it more. But instead, he becomes a crime lord. Convincingly, again, if the character doesn't make any sense to me, it makes a lot of sense to Tupac based on how... I guess I'll say seamless. He makes that transition within the character. I'm just saying the character doesn't make any sense.
So you think that in real life there are people that are seeing dudes strung out and on a ditch, you know, like, okay, so let's just say this is drugs instead of just going to prison. Your dad is strung out on drugs. You might see him sucking dick for some coke around the corner, right? How many people do you think that has actually stopped from going and doing cocaine? Nobody. Like, if you want to do coke, you're going to do coke. You see, if I see, like,
I would push back slightly. Like, the stakes are lower, but like, I have uncles who drink an unsafe amount of alcohol, and I have cousins who are sober as a direct response to that.
I felt like there's not enough, like, for where he went, there wasn't enough time to pass the movie. It felt very sudden to go from what we're watching to.
Yeah, like, you get a sense that, like, this is going to be about Omar Epps becoming a DJ. And then they're like, we're going to go rob this convenience store. You need to put off this DJ competition.
As much as I enjoyed Omar Epps, I wish we would spend more time with Tupac behind the scenes as well. Like,
yes.
Like, just seeing what really got hit. Like, so it's like Macbeth shit, right? Just super paranoid. How did we get there? From a grandma that was cooking you breakfast and the semi-comatose dad, and I get that. I would just wish we would get and spend more time with him.
We might be able to make a sequel. We know Tupac's not dead, so.
That's right.
He survived a drive-by. He survived a fall off of a tenement house. He'll be fine.
Maybe this is just Tupac being probably much better at this than they ever expected, that made his role pop out so much in this movie, too. Like, it may not have been like, you may have written this movie down on paper, and he doesn't seem that interesting of a character, but then you see him on screen, and...
Where is he at in his musical career in 1992? Is he, like, a couple albums in,
album
or is he, like, out. A major... Or is he...
One album out, another album about to drop probably 6 months after this.
Yeah. So he was...
If you were writing a review at the time, you wouldn't call him, like, a superstar rapper.
I would...
You might even call him like a musician turned actor.
Primarily musician for sure. I wouldn't want to say he was up and coming because he was already there, but he wasn't worldwide famous, I don't think, in 92.
California Love hadn't come out yet.
No. Because he hasn't gone to prison yet at this point. He's only, 92? Would have only been,
he was, yeah,
what,
he was in
21?
His early 20s. Yeah, early 20s.
Which is insane.
Yeah, so... All of the songs you know from Tupac are basically from Me Against the World and All Eyes on Me. And so that's Me Against the World doesn't come out for another 3 years. The only album he had out was Tupacalypse, which still hasn't gone platinum in the last, you know, I mean, it's been 30 years since then, and it still hasn't gone platinum. So you just got to think, like, this is... Nobody even talks about the thing that was out before this movie was made.
Yeah.
Something else I was thinking about as far as the specific time this came out in. This is like 2 years before the crime bill and Hillary Clinton giving her super predator speech. Like, she's got Tupac in her mind in this movie when she's giving it. I doubt Hillary Clinton had seen Juice, but this is what a certain type of person is afraid of. Like a kid who just all of a sudden decides he's going to become armed robber / murderer of his closest friends. So, like, I started off my review, like, this is the kind of movie that would only be able to be made by a black person, because a white person making this movie would be like, this shit is racist.
Yeah. I'm pretty sure some white people made this movie in the 90s as well.
Oh, yeah, no question, no question. Ernest Dickerson... He's never going to write another movie again after this one. It's just this movie. And I really want to stress that, like, the start of this movie is so strong. And I just don't understand why he had to turn it into this skid. I would have just enjoyed hanging out. I would have enjoyed the DJ becoming a DJ, DJ contest, whatever. Equivalent of white person ski lodge movie. Great.
Yeah.
I would watch that. I would watch that, and I would enjoy it with these characters. Omar Epps, I think, is totally underrated. I don't know what he's been doing for the last 15 years, 20 years, whatever.
TJ?
Making black movies. I've seen him in tons of stuff. White ass.
But, like, after The Wood and after Love and Basketball? Or is all that stuff prior to that?
I mean, the dude was in House for, like, 8 seasons.
Oh, House. Okay, great. He got paid. Good for him.
Yeah. I mean, but he's one of those guys that just, like, shows up in movies that only black people watch.
A shame. I'm
pretty sure he's in a movie that's on Netflix right now.
Do you think Omar Epps is, like, too recognizable where he's like, oh, fuck, that's Omar Epps?
No. I don't have any sense. I have not seen him in anything since Love and Basketball, I think.
I don't know. Every time he's out, and maybe because this movie, because it hit me, you know, like I watch this, like, watch this in the right, like, what, the mid-90s. Where everything was impressionable, I'm like, every time I see Omar Epps, I'm like, oh, I love Omar Epps.
Yeah, he's great. He's great. Is this Tupac's best movie? He only made like 4 or 5, I think.
What, Above the Rim?
That's the only other one I've seen.
Definitely
I don't...
better than Above the Rim.
Poetic Justice.
I've not actually seen Poetic Justice.
This is probably the best one.
This is better than Gridlock, for sure.
Gridlock, that's the one I was thinking of.
And is there a fourth one? There's a fourth one.
We said 4.
Yeah, that Gridlock was 4th.
What?
Yeah. I added that.
Oh, Above the Rim, Poetic Justice.
Okay, we got Nothing But Trouble, Juice, Poetic Justice, Above the Rim, Murder. Murder Was a Case is a little thing about Snoop Dogg, obviously. Bullet, Gridlock, Gang Related.
Gang Related. Oh, Jim Belushi.
That I was imagining the poster and not being able to think of
that
it.
That was supposed to be the big movie, but that was just...
I mean, you get star-wadded to Jim Belushi with you. You've got to think 100 mil easy.
That's what I was... I was looking at the cover of that literally before we started this podcast. And I was like, oh, that's right. That happened. Jim Belushi, star of The Principal.
I'm sure they had great conversations after the camera stopped rolling. Anything else on Juice? Two good movies.
Samuel L. Jackson is great. That's what I got to say.
You can never get enough Samuel L. Jackson. He's not going to be bad at anything.
Yeah. They were just like, can you play what everyone think is like just you?
Our last movie is Da 5 Bloods, speaking of Spike Lee. This is his most recent movie released direct to Netflix. This is a very long Vietnam War-ish adjacent epic about four elderly, they must be in their 60s, 4 men who return to Vietnam in the present day to both retrieve the remains of their fallen comrade, the Fifth Blood, and also a giant stash of gold that, we're going to talk about my confusion somewhat with the events of this movie, but I feel like I think he died at more or less the same time he retrieved the gold. But they're going after both, is the point. This being a Spike Lee movie, it is about a whole lot. Spike Lee either moonlights as a professor or a director. I don't really know anymore. But you can really see his professorial instincts on display here with a lot of cuts to historical black figures, famous and under recognized. Both, and just his constant obsession with including everything that's currently in his head in whatever movie he's making at that moment. What did we think of Da 5 Bloods, Shane?
I don't know. Like, there's so much of this movie that I like, and then there's some parts I just don't necessarily care for. I think I like him more than you do, I suspect.
Yeah. I was deeply irritated by most of this movie.
Oh, I was not irritated at almost any of it. And I think point two is like where I'd like to go to, but JR, where are you at on this?
Probably like a C plus. Just there were parts that I hated. For instance, I hated every time they cut to a black and white picture or something. Like, I hated that. I was like, this, like it felt like it just every time he did that, it stopped the whole flow of the movie. And you know, you're just like, God damn it! Like, just like if you want to get that in there, if you want to make it some reference to something, you need to be able to do it within the flow of the movie, not stop the flow, show a picture of fucking some Black Panthers, and then just have this picture be up for 15 seconds, and then go back to these dudes talking again.
See, yeah, you're transitioning from the supreme visual medium of cinema and making a PowerPoint presentation, like the least visual medium.
I thought 3D was the best. Was the supreme three? Was the supreme?
Visual. Why not 4K IMAX?
4K IMAX.
3D. 4K IMAX. 4D. Yeah.
What if you saw a PowerPoint presentation in 4K? Imagine the wipes.
Now in Smell-O-Vision.
Star wipe always.
Isn't that
a thing? Yeah. Joke. I think that was a real thing in the '80s. They were just trying some shit out. Yeah.
Isn't that the Cinco chair, movie chair?
That does sound familiar.
Yeah.
A quality invention, a quality chair.
Hey, so I'll push back against you guys a little bit on this because I don't mind that near as much as you guys. There are other parts about this movie that bother me way more than just the.
Oh yeah,
the there pictures are... of abject real violence, because you watch this movie and there's violence and there's cinema violence, but then you see the black and white pictures of not only historical figures but what actually happened in Vietnam. People that there's always the famous picture of the guy being shot in the head.
There's the famous picture of the guy having a gun held to his head,
right.
And the famous caption: "This man was executed seconds later." Not the arc of blood coming out of his head.
Right.
That is not seen. And like, there's an argument to be made for, like, if we're more honest with what actual violence looks like, would we perhaps be less likely to perpetuate it? That's a totally fine and good debate.
And I will say no. And I will say no, because white people not having melanin in their skin, they are inherently savage.
That is a very good joke. Push back on the reality, because it is.
But that shot comes in like the first 30 seconds of the movie.
Yeah.
Not shot. That,
well,
that footage
that
comes
particular.
In the first 30
but
seconds.
But there's
of the
a
movie.
Lot
like,
more.
If you're
to go along with it, it doesn't jar me out, because I know this is a fucking Spike Lee movie, so I'm just like, whatever. What are we gonna do?
Sure. And like, this came up in Black Klansman as well. Like, Black Klansman ends with, and it's not like he's done this in a lot of his filmography, but like, Black Klansman ends with Charlottesville footage, Heather Heyer being, I think you see her attempting to be revived and, you know, failing at the end of that movie. So like, I always have an issue with that. I don't know. I tend not to watch police brutality videos for the same reason. Like, I don't necessarily want to see an actual human being's life expire. And like, that's kind of a bargain I'm making by watching movies that might very well be about war, but I'm not watching an actual real death happening. And like, Spike Lee is making that decision for me. And this is a very small part of this movie.
Well, I don't think the challenge is for you necessarily then, because the people wouldn't just consider Andy's people dying, person dying. It's just a statistic. That's it. And you see, I think it's very, you talk about what we're going through with the pandemic itself, where people are like, it's okay. Everyone who's dying has pre-existing conditions. Like, what are those pre-existing conditions? Oh, you're obese, or you had diabetes, or you had asthma, like, as if that life doesn't matter. Until you see someone die, you see these police brutality videos, you see someone just, which I have not watched, the kneeling on the neck, that I can't do it again, but people are in denial and they need to see it. So if this is something that shows how horrific some of this can be and what a human dying looks like, I think that's important.
I think we're going to put a pin in that, because the two the two big, like, famous images of Vietnamese war violence that are in this movie are both that execution and the girl running down the road.
Right.
We're going to come back to that and how the movie feels about Vietnamese people.
Yeah, okay.
But to the plot of the movie itself, Delroy Lindo is receiving extensive praise and accolades and anticipation for his eventual Oscar whenever that happens. I want to say in May of next year, maybe. He plays the most affected veteran of the war. He is really going for it. He is acting with tremendous passion. And I personally think that he is overacting the fuck out of this movie. I think he's going so big, he makes the movie worse. He makes other characters worse by being around someone who is acting in this fashion. What did you guys think of Delroy Lindo, JR?
Bro, that is just how old black people are, bro.
But there are three old black people in the movie also who are not like that in any way, shape, or form.
Yeah, but
he's
but like him. That is well within the spectrum of old black guy. Like, there are old black dudes that act like that, and their PTSD isn't they were in a war. Their PTSD is like they fucking, you know, saw somebody die. Like, yeah, like one thing happened to him back in fucking 98, and they're like fucking jacked up about it. That's well within the spectrum of everything that happened. 100% believable to me. Way over the top. Black people, when you get them going, they're way over the top. Like, it's believable. Also, so by extension, do you know,
like, you're pro Delroy Lindo. Like, when he's walking away into the bush and he's like, he's like yelling and crying loudly. That was fine.
That was fine for me, but it also was like a Spike Lee joint. That's how he probably did one take, and Spike Lee was like, "I need you to go higher, go harder."
It jarred me a little bit, but I got used to it by the end, I think. So it didn't bother me as much as it did. It felt like overacting, but it's also a Spike Lee movie where I feel as if things are supposed to be a little bit exaggerated and ridiculous to begin with.
Yeah, as far as like the level of elevation in the course of Spike Lee's movies, as far as like elevated acting, there's like, sure, you've got Bugging Out in Do the Right Thing. You've got Giancarlo Esposito again in School Days. Yeah, there's a lot of examples. Delroy Lindo is quite possibly the most elevated. God, again, I'm going to say hammy. I thought he was hammy as fuck. Just the hammiest character in the whole thing.
I do not think you're wrong, but it was intentional. So it didn't bother me much because it was self-aware that...
I'm always leery of that kind of thing where, like, badness is baked into something. Like, oh, yeah, he's bad on purpose.
Bad, but I just don't think... Yeah, I still think that was necessarily the focus of it. And maybe it's jarring because I keep going back to his performance in particular for this movie. I keep going back to it. Like, I want to rewatch this movie because I want to rewatch exactly what he was saying.
As far as his character, Paul, as a Trump supporter, is that in this movie only because Spike Lee wanted an excuse to have the hat in the movie? I kind of think it's just because of that. I think it's just because he wanted to be able to throw the hat around as a constant reminder of the specific time and place.
I fucking love it. It's a great choice. This guy is just pissed off at everything, right? And no one's voting for Trump because they're rational, unless they're fucking rich. Everyone who's broke and fucking vote for Trump is pissed off at everything. This guy's just fucking broke. Like, he says in the movie, "I'm going to get mine this time." He's like, "I'm going to be the guy behind Trump at one of his rallies." I fucking get it.
It was just all meta. It was all meta for me. It was all symbolism of the hat. It was just the hat. He wanted the hat in the movie.
Jay, are you still muted on this?
No, I agree with Shane. I had nothing else to say. I should have just said I agree with Shane. Dude, I mean...
Well, no, you can't say that enough. You can keep saying it.
I agree with Shane. They're always fucking mad.
It's always mad.
If you give them something to direct their anger to, they're always happy to do that. And so if a dude gets up there and says, hey, we're all pissed off, let's fucking hate Mexicans, they're going to be like, yeah, fuck it. Let's hate Mexicans. Doesn't matter what they are, as long as they're not Mexican. And really, maybe if they're Mexican, they might still do it.
Because they were here first, and the other Mexicans came after. Didn't do it the right way.
Shane mentioned a potential rewatch. A rewatch might also do me well, because just like some basic plot points like went over my head. Why they're going back right now? Like, Vietnam's been an open country with the U.S. for like 30 years at this point. As far as why they went back now, I missed that.
Let's see. They're sitting at a table. They say, the guy goes, why are you coming back now? And they said, well, a landslide happened. And, well, we tried to come back later. We tried to come back earlier, but we couldn't find anything on the map. And then a landslide happened, and it revealed the tail of the plane where our friend died. Boom. Was that it?
That's fine. I totally missed that. The other plot point that I missed, Norman, the Fifth Blood, who died during the during the conflict, played by Chadwick Boseman, framed as their leader and as this icon of black manhood in the 60s. I was totally unclear how he died. I did not understand that Paul Delroy Lindo's character killed him because of how the scene was framed. Like, this, if this is the pivotal moment of his life, it should be 100% clear that he killed him.
So, pivotal moment of whose life?
Paul's. What I thought happened was that the Vietnamese soldier, the Viet Cong soldier, who's like creeping in to kill both of them, kills Norman, and then Paul spins around and kills her. It never entered my brain that he had killed Norman. Not only because it's a shitty death, he gets shot in the gut and like falls dead. It doesn't make any sense. Also, it looked like the exit wound was in his front. And if, you know, if you shoot someone, you get a small wound in the front and big wound in the back.
I'm not going to argue about exit wounds because you're the expert here. But
sure. Yes.
How many people have you shot, John? Yeah, what the fuck?
Let's just move on.
Let's just say he didn't pay rent when he lived here, okay?
I do. See, again, this is a question of interpretation. I took that point as, like, I performed hits for you. But you were saying you were afraid. Okay.
Yes,
see, again. So again, I'm allowing for me being just completely wrong and
I mean, you used to perform. It was like a Juice situation. You used to be on the same team, and then it quickly.
Yes, so, Juice made no sense to me because it resonated so clearly. I will turn on you like that.
Yeah.
You know why we haven't heard from Brian for so long? Continue with your point.
Oh, Brian, if you're out there. We're yellow in your next Instagram post. It's surprising to me that you didn't catch this. I'm not going to say this next line to kiss your ass here, but you are more or less the one who taught me how to critically look at movies and TV and pay attention. So the fact that you kind of missed this and some other stuff is weird to me.
I don't interpret Paul's specific agony over this whole, like, it could be just as agonizing for being present at the moment of his death, for failing to protect his mentor. Well, it doesn't necessarily have to be that he actually killed him.
Yeah.
I'm surprised by this at two levels. Is before they even show it, probably an hour, I don't know, how long was the movie? 3 hours long? Like,
yeah.
They show him with 10 minutes left, they show him, or 20 minutes left, or whatever. An hour before that, you can tell that this dude killed Paul.
In what you were saying, Shane, as far as like being someone who has a sense of how a movie is going to go, like, yeah, once you realize they're withholding the moment of Norman's death to practically the very end of the movie, you're like, yeah, sure, this is going to be important.
Like, every time they talk about this dude, about Paul, he has some visceral reaction to it. And you're like, you know, I mean, they're like, hey, he talks to him in his sleep, like all this stuff. The whole time I'm thinking, this dude killed him.
See, I thought, when the son shows up.
Yeah, I was like, this dude killed him.
I thought he failed to protect him. I knew there was guilt there. But I also thought the scene where he shoots him, I'm like, yeah, he shot him.
I thought the guilt
was too much for it to have been failed to protect him. And then also, like you said, very clearly killed this man in the scene where he did it.
Like, on a scale of 1 to 100, where 1 is, who could tell what happened, to 100, John should be embarrassed of himself right now.
Like a 4. Like, it came up in all of the podcasts I listened to about this movie over the last week. Like, everybody was pretty clear on that. Like, oh, yeah, that it was just taken as gospel that Paul's just beating himself up. He's been beating himself up for 50 years for having killed his mentor. Whereas, like, I'm just like, I just thought he was in the plane fuselage when he died.
I think it's really, it was.
So as far as like the timing of it, was Norman killed when they found the gold? Was that the same moment? Because it takes place in a plane, in like a plane fuselage where they also found the gold.
Yes, not in the exact same moment, but like shortly after. Yes,
that timeline is less clear. And like I think what is so weird about it, to your credit, is it happens really fast, and that's it.
He turns and fires. I find that there is any question at all to be a failure of the movie, even if everybody else figured this out. Even if they did, again, I find it to be a failure of the movie. It should be crystal clear.
But do you really want him celebrating his death, and getting shot up? Like, does he have to be a glorious death? Like,
no, it doesn't.
Like Bishop flying off the building.
I think also him having killed Norman through friendly fire is the least interesting outcome. I feel like survivor's guilt in general is a more complex emotion than like actual guilt, especially in a war setting.
I don't know if everyone else knew that's what he did though.
Nobody else knew.
Yeah.
No one else.
He dies having told no one.
Yeah.
They don't know it. Like, the only survivor is Clark Peters, and he doesn't know.
Don't you think that adds something to it?
Not really.
That he's been holding on to it. Not only did your
and then he's absolved.
Dude, your guy. This person who should not have been slogging through a fucking jungle fighting people that he shouldn't give a shit about dies over there, but you're the one who did it, and all that guilt that you're carrying. Not only did you fail him, but you're the one who shot him.
I don't know. People die by friendly fire all the time in war zones. And I don't
and the government imagine
that moral hazard to be any worse than killing a squad of Viet Cong soldiers who were talking about the poetry their wife sent them.
But it is different. Yeah,
I fundamentally disagree, and this gets into our talking about the Viet.
Outside of the fact that you're just seeing it as two deaths, this dude is as they said in the movie, he worshipped this guy like. The dude that you think is God, essentially, you end up killing him. Like, that's totally different than you just wiping out some dude that you don't know anything about him. He's just the enemy, and you've been trained to kill.
All this success of all this is based on dehumanization of the other side. Either you kill them or they're going to kill you. And so killing one of your quote-unquote own, because I do think we are, I don't know, for lack of a word, tribal by nature. We all group off, and our brains compartmentalize everything naturally and put us in groups. I think it's important. And the fact that he killed one of his group, and not only was it someone in his group, it was their fucking leader. Like JR said, like that makes a huge difference in why this guy is so, so broken.
That'll get us into how the movie treats and feels about the Vietnamese. Like, the movie the movie starts with Muhammad Ali talking about the Vietnam. No Viet Cong ever called me the N-word. Those tribal associations that Shane was talking about, by starting the movie with that phrase, the movie is automatically skeptical of those tribal associations. Like, there's no such thing as countries, there's no such thing as races, et cetera, et cetera. There's only human beings. And we have to deal with all this stuff because we've broken the world in such a way, and it's hard to just pretend the world has begun anew without all these racial and national associations. However, I think the movie treats the Vietnamese horribly.
Do they?
Does horribly. It? Yes. They there's a very depiction of the Vietnamese, and you know, for all this is a Spike Lee movie, and with like one or possibly two exceptions, all of his movies have been like race is the first, second, and third focus. And that's generally the case here as well. But he didn't write the first draft of the script. Like, he acquired this script and then rewrote it to fit the milieu that he wanted to set it in. It didn't have to be about Vietnam. It could have been about any war. Could have been about Korea. Could have been about Iraq. Could have been about World War I, whatever. Any war, if Spike Lee's going to direct it, any war that has black soldiers fighting in it, black American soldiers fighting in it. By being about the Vietnamese war, fine. But by choosing to make it about the Vietnamese war, like, you're bringing in a lot of subtext to that specific time, and especially if you're going to start with a quote from a famous conscientious the most famous conscientious objector, who, you know, will not go kill people who are, in his words, you know, the poor like him. So how does this movie feel about these people that our main characters are going to go murder, and murder efficiently and well? It's not just that Norman is, you know, teaching them about their own history and their place in the world. It's also that he's a great soldier,
right?
That he's great at killing Vietnamese. So in the present day, yes, there's a very depiction of the Vietnamese. Like, their guide has South Vietnamese soldiers in his past, and his family was put into re-education camps after the war ended. But there's also Jean Reno's goons, who are just hired guns and cannon fodder, 4 to 5 bloods. There's Otis's old girlfriend, who is not a character, and even less of a character is his daughter, who
is
awful. And the rest are, you know, beggars and salesmen populating the margins of the country.
So I think it was intentional to place the just not caring about them in the war, and to contrast that with their guide is this Vietnamese man who had, and everyone they run into had these complicated past, like whose dad served on what side. And I thought it was very complicated what they did outside of the daughter was just
awful. Terrible. Can't stress enough how awful it is. Like, the main goon of Jean Reno, who Paul like guts with a knife. There's like some attempt to make him into a human, but he's also the first one murdered, and Jean Reno is the last one murdered, despite him being bloated and well into his 80s, it seems like.
I just felt like the Vietnamese themselves, the modern, it just sort of, I've obviously never been to Vietnam. If we had Brian,
Cartman has,
had you not murdered Brian,
we'll edit that out.
we could have had his opinion what Vietnam is like now, which he says is a lovely country, but it's got to be very complicated for a lot of people, I imagine.
I'm sure, and I don't think this movie was complicated at all.
I disagree with that. I felt like this, which I don't care for, which is my biggest knock on this movie, is the amount of violence towards the back end of this that I really feel like just is so different from the front.
Yeah.
Of this movie.
The stuff in the Vietnam War as well. There's just so many different ways you could potentially frame a black soldier's experience in that period of time. Like, Martin Luther King's assassination happens in the course of the movie, and they learn about it through the local propagandist on the radio. There's like well-documented instances of that occurring, and white soldiers whipping out their Confederate flags and like celebrating around the campfires back at the base. Of all directors, like Spike Lee wouldn't include that in the movie.
I don't think you want to focus on the white soldiers at all, though.
But it's if you're Spike Lee and you have a chance to like depict white people acting badly, specifically in that exact way, it's strange for you not to take it up.
That has nothing to do with what he's trying to do, though. That's, I guess you're just saying, why not throw it in there?
Yeah, the movie is about like the contradiction of fighting for a country that is not on your side, and what better demonstration of that than exactly that? Part of the point of the movie is that the enemy is that you're fighting an enemy who is not your enemy. Who is your enemy?
I feel like he has such utter disrespect for Confederate waving white people.
Yes, it made no sense in Chirac. It would have made sense here.
There's no way you can throw a Topher Grace in here. Like, you know, with that Confederate flag, and that's what I feel like he feels like about all the Confederate flag waving dudes. It just doesn't have any place. It doesn't need it. I really liked the propaganda radio bits that they did and the Defy Bloods listening to that part of it. I thought it was really well done.
Yeah.
You don't need anything else.
It's classic Spike Lee to include, you know, like a historically accurate character in this case, but like a DJ type, Samuel L. Jackson and Do the Right Thing being the obvious comparison. She is a propagandist. He was working for a communist government.
Yeah.
He's going to put people in re-education camps at the end of the war. But yeah, yeah.
She wasn't wrong with what she's saying either. So it was, I thought.
But I feel that the movie is so conflicted about that. Like, we want to include North Vietnamese communists speaking truth to American soldiers. But we also want to communicate that our American soldier characters are awesome by how efficiently they blow up Vietnamese soldiers. So is there a better way to communicate the awesomeness of our main characters other than just the portrayal of them as Chadwick Boseman, who, you know, is an incredible like physical presence?
You didn't feel like any of that was some unreliable narrator stuff?
No, I don't think that's in the movie at all.
Okay.
Whatever happens, happens.
Okay.
I think the angel of Norman indeed comes down and absolves Paul before he is lit up. I think that is a true, that's not a vision. I think that's a true thing that happens in the movie.
You're always,
it's so earnest.
You think so?
I do think so.
I thought you were cracking wise.
I'm not. I think.
Oh, you're being legit right now.
I am, yes. There's so many God references, and I understand that like,
Did you get into my edibles before you watched?
Definitely not. Okay. The last podcast that will never be heard. You know, never again.
What was that? Was that last podcast?
It was. Yes. Like, the fan. There's just too much interference. I'm not comfortable releasing it to our broader audience.
Isn't it wild how when you walk, you go forward?
Classic John. I don't know, JR. You want to jump in? We kind of segued from the Vietnamese to Norman specifically, but...
Yeah, I want to say that I don't think that the story was, look at how dope our super murderous people are. It was less the film wanted you to be like, oh, this super efficient killer's awesome, versus they just wanted you to understand that's why this dude was who he was. That's why Paul loved him. That's why everybody fell underneath him. It's because he could kill, he was an efficient killer and was going to get them back home. That's why they loved him. They were ready to follow him wherever because they were all going to come out on the other side because this dude knew what he was doing.
Something else I felt was really missing from the Vietnam segments that would have just made this movie a lot more complex and a lot more thorny would have been like the actual lived experience of Vietnamese troops were like, does anybody know what fragging is? where enlisted men kill officers. That shit happened all the time in Vietnam. And why would enlisted men kill officers?
They don't want to follow orders.
They don't want to follow orders. Maybe they don't want to. Maybe they don't want to risk their lives in the jungle for. Maybe they don't want to take another hill that they're just going to give up the next day. Maybe they have no sense of the overall mission. Maybe they don't want to blow up a village full of women and children. Many, many, many reasons why that could have possibly happened. And again, if this movie is about what is it like to fight for a country that is not on your side?
Is that what the movie is about?
I do think so. I think that's the broadest like historical / political point in the movie. It is also about.
But you can make a point in a movie without the movie being about that. Like you keep saying that that's what it's about, and it didn't feel to me like it was about that. It was. Like, yes, that comes up, but it doesn't, to me, that's not what the movie's main focus is.
Were there any, I don't know if you guys know this at all, I have no idea. I've never looked at it. Were there any people who defected to the other side in Vietnam? Well, it's like from this and Watchmen that we've seen in the past year, we have this propaganda saying, why are you fighting for somebody who doesn't
want you? Yeah.
I'm just curious if anyone actually did defect. Said, yeah, you know what, right? Fuck this.
It's a rich, fertile territory.
Yeah.
For something more complicated than I spun around too quickly and shot my buddy. it just becomes a standard war story alongside this heist part of the movie that, again, we can talk about that as well, but I feel like that's muddled as fuck.
The heist is muddled. But I feel like we've talked about enough to make this more than just a standard war story.
Yeah, like there is a lot, because it is so long, because there is so much jammed into it, to its detriment, in my opinion. Yeah, there is a lot to discuss in this movie, which is an argument in its favor.
I will say Blair only watched like the middle 90 minutes and is confused as to why I thought like it was kind of not very good. Although I think this conversation is talking me up on it a little bit, actually. But I was like, yeah, the beginning and especially the ending is not great. It just kind of devolves into whatever the fuck it devolves into.
Yeah, the
violence. When we start getting the landmine shit involved, it just
terrible. Terrible.
As soon as that first landmine goes off, it's downhill for the movie.
Yes. Up until then, I think we're looking at like a B+, A- movie for me. And then it just drops precipitously.
I was pretty irritated with it by that point already, and then the landmine got stepped on. The landmine got stepped on in the most inorganic, inhuman, man is a robot way possible. And yes, the movie did get worse from there, but it wasn't in a great place. Like, if you're going to introduce these bystanders of this anti-landmine group, fantastic. You've introduced the possibility of landmines into this movie. That is both a strong plot element, and it's thematically resonant as well, like the after effects of this war. Like a thread going through the movie is that for people that live that go through a war, the war never ends. Fantastic. Here's an explosive reminder of exactly that if you're going to live in Vietnam, you just have to deal with the fact that you might one day step on a landmine. What's to be done about it? And then we proceed to a point in the movie where the characters are like greedily digging through the ground, and are super excited when they hit a metallic clang.
And you're like, that's gonna be a landmine.
Why wouldn't it be a landmine? Right. How could it not be a landmine? Like, what a great like that. In listening to a lot of commentary about this movie, like Spike Lee has talked about his favorite movie being The Treasure of the Sierra Madre, which is not a movie I've seen, but my understanding of it is that. It's a jungle expedition for buried treasure and the search
it's
for
this
gold.
It's a fucking movie.
Yeah, the search for gold like corrupts the characters and they make more and more rash decisions, et cetera, et cetera. What better rash decision than digging greedily into the ground with a shovel and like blowing up a landmine and killing yourself because you were too greedy for the gold? Robot behavior.
Lectures everyone about greed.
Terrible.
And then walked backwards.
So irritated. For some reason why. So irritated.
You know how you guys are always walking backwards in the woods.
Mm.
I've seen you do it in your back of your house, John. It's really weird.
The movie sets itself up perfectly. Like they find the gold, they find the crate, and Isaiah Whitlock Jr. is like running his metal detector, like, and whenever he gets the beep, it must be gold. What if it wasn't gold? What if it was something else and you didn't think about it?
I didn't like that the whole landmine people came back. I thought it was fine. Why didn't he be back in that movie?
Yes. The movie wants to suggest that there's some kind of romantic chemistry between Paul's son, played by Jonathan Majors, from The Last Black Man in San Francisco. And
the most jacked dude wearing a medium shirt of all time.
And the French female leader of the anti-landmine group. They have no chemistry together. She is not a character in this movie. Her comrade, a Finn, who for some reason is portrayed as a snooty European towards Americans who have never more deserved snootiness at this point in our history. The movie hates him and practically laughs and applauds when he gets blown up by a landmine. Why are they in the movie?
It's so weird. The whole thing is off the rails at that point.
We haven't said this, and I really want to say it before I forget.
Please.
I don't remember which guy, what the name of the dude was that jumped on the landmine, but remember, like, they're talking earlier in the movie, and he's like, I damn sure wouldn't jump on a landmine for you motherfuckers. And you're like, God damn it, Spike Lee. Like, could you fucking signal this anymore? That this dude's clearly going to jump on a grenade. That's what it was.
Clearly, and again, as far as logistics, as far as geography, not clear he has to do that.
Not
clear. The grenade didn't land right next to Clark Peters. They're in a stone temple. It might have been totally fine if a grenade blew up in this general vicinity, and everyone would have been okay. And that grenade also was thrown by ancient, decrepit, bloated Jean Reno. Like, and he kills two of them. He kills Isaiah Whitlock and he kills somebody else. I can't remember. I thought the action in The Five Bloods, I thought was just complete garbage.
And we're happy with him saying she.
No, hated it. Hated it.
I'm happy with everything.
I hated it.
I know it's.
Oh, he says it in everything he's in now, though.
He did not say it in Cedar Rapids. Even though he does an impression of a character from The Wire in that movie.
So good.
Which I thought was the perfect inclusion of Isaiah. Like, if you expect something to happen, it's better that it doesn't happen. As I said in my review on MediaCommovie.club, the Wikipedia page about Black soldiers' experience in Vietnam is far more dramatically dense than anything in The Five Bloods. This is just the most straightforward service-level approach that does not get into like the thorny morality that I wanted and want from any movie going forward about the Vietnam War.
So you wanted this movie, it's pretty clear, like, after hearing this, you wanted this movie to be about something completely different than it is about, though.
Not necessarily.
Like, everything you've said has been like, I wish instead of doing this, they did this wholly different thing in this. When they talked about these guys in Vietnam, instead of them worshiping this murderer, I wish they did something that had nothing to do with this guy and did this other thing. Like, you want a realistic Vietnam movie when this is not about the Vietnam War, is the delivery to the breakdown of this relationship because of them coming back to the war and where they had the war and remembering stuff, but it's not about the Vietnam War.
Well, I think we disagree. I think we disagree about that. Like, there is something to what you're saying in that this movie wasn't originally written, you know, for Spike Lee, and it could have easily been transferred to a different war, as we were saying. But if you're going to transfer it to the Vietnamese War, I do feel like there are certain expectations.
Why is the expectation that if you're talking about the Vietnam War, it has to be about the wildness of the war and not the war as a vehicle to something?
Just because of the historical context it was taking place in. Like,
who cares about this historical context?
The movie cares about historical context by including the power.
No, it, It does, but that's not the main point of the movie, though. That's what I'm saying. Like, it can do that, but the main point of the movie is not that. And I feel like you're wanting the main point of the movie to be that. Is what
I hear what you're saying. It's not great criticism to judge the movie that you want instead of the movie that is. That is correct and valid.
Are we all in agreement that this movie would be better? So it was about 3 hours long. The last hour was the landmine violence, the heist shit. I think, can we all agree? Do we all agree that it would have been better just to follow these guys devolving on their own as opposed to all this other bullshit that was coming into it?
I would agree with that.
I feel like that'd be more interesting. I'd rather spend more time with these guys as opposed to than some Finnish guy who's snooty.
Generally, with Spike Lee, just the narrower the movie can get, the better. Because if you give him the opportunity to include like a non sequitur scene of his main character, you know, tying up a National Guard general with the Confederate flag that he keeps in his office. If you can prevent him from doing that, so much the better. He wants to include whatever he's thinking about. Like the whole thing with like the Oxycontin, I feel like he just read a New Yorker article about
the opiate crisis. I thought it was going to matter more and it didn't matter at all. This is weird.
He has a bad hip. He needs pain pills. Leave him alone.
Got it.
Leave him alone.
Or at least have it come back and they got to leave this dude in the jungle behind. If you're gonna have the fight, you got to leave this dude to die behind in the fight. He's got to sacrifice himself because he can't walk any further. Some shit like that.
Yeah, I feel like his hip doesn't really come up.
Oxy with it. Yeah.
It doesn't make him a liability in the end. It's just Spike Lee wrote a New Yorker article.
Yeah.
Your pushback is well taken, JR. I mean, what would you think? What did you think? Like the main takeaway of the movie was?
I think the main takeaway is the grief breaking down family or breaking down friendship and stuff. I mean, I just watched Final Frontier, so that might be why it's in my head right now. Because in that movie, they're stealing money and everything goes wrong because they Triple see Frontier? How much money there is. Triple Frontier, yeah. Literally, we just watched it today. So it's like, it seemed like a parallel. So maybe that's why I'm thinking about it. But that's what it seemed like to me. And then like Shane said, I could see where you don't think that. Because right when it starts breaking down, like they start breaking down, the fucking landmine goes off. And then it turns into a damn shitty action movie.
What did we think of the gore effects on the least famous of the foursome? I thought that was so mean and pointless.
Yeah, and also the guy's the most handsome of all of them, too. It's, like, so jarring.
So
the gore effects, that was better than the fake blood that spewed out of the home right before he got, right after he got absolved by Norm. My God, I was like,
yeah.
Damn, I could have done this on my computer. How bad this fake blood was coming out of everybody.
I mean, like as far as the blood in this pseudo war movie, like the most chilling use of it is Isaiah Whitlock Jr. face down on the ground after having a grenade explode in his stomach, and like the blood just gradually seeping out and like creating a puddle. Far more than.
Yeah.
The abject cruelty of this character who the movie wants us to care about, and now here he is with a third of a torso and no hands, like choking out his last breath. What is the point of that? I thought that was, again, just the weird choices in this movie.
What this movie is about, I keep going back to that, maybe just because I just watched a Stand By Me, listen to the Stand By Me thing, it just talking about you have friends who float into your life at a certain point, and sometimes they're nothing more than the line from the movie is nothing more than a waiter at dinner, right? And at certain points in your life, you can only have been friends with these people at that point in your life. And I felt like that's where we're going. That's part of it, and the part we all drift away, and there's all these the racial undertones of what is going on, and that's what united these guys. And now we visit them so many years later, and their friendship needed to be more than that, but it just gets fucking blown up by a fucking like landmine.
I think that a very early shot of them in the club, like a tracking shot of them dancing through, like I think that shot is doing a lot of work, because as much as this movie irritated me, there is some great stuff in it. One thing being like the a cappella Marvin Gaye montage, fantastic. Other thing being that I think that shot is one of the better shots in Spike Lee's entire career, of these four like 60 plus year old black dudes strutting through a club called Apocalypse Now in
really well done
in Vietnam, fantastic. And but as good as that shot is, I do wish there was something a little stronger and more sustained to establish their chemistry. But to take it back to what I feel like was an hour ago, I feel like Delroy Lindo is so overpowering that he just strangles in its crib any rapport that these guys might have. And you don't really get any of it from their Vietnam flashbacks either. Their Vietnam flashbacks are primary. If they're not straight up battle scenes, it's Norman lecturing them.
But it's because they have the one united thing that they can focus on, and that's it.
Yeah.
And that's not enough to make a lifetime friendship. You have a shared experience does not mean you should be friends for a lifetime.
I would push back on that, having never fought in a war myself and never will, that experience might very well be potent enough
you have this shared experience and you can be friends for life, but can you have a friendship for life? Do you want to hang out with the people you had this traumatic experience with all the time?
Yeah. Are you just going to be thinking about Norm all the time every time you see these dudes?
Right.
All the crazy shit that went down.
The brass ring.
I feel like the experience of soldiers like says yes, you do want us.
I don't think that's universal.
VFW branches across the country might disagree.
VFW branches are full of white people too, who just love talking.
And not Vietnam necessarily either. They were famously.
But when you go there, you don't hang out with people that you had the experience with. You hang out with these other dudes who had similar experiences, but you maybe
not specifically yours. Sure, we don't know what the fuck we're talking about.
Or here. Sometimes you go on Brian's bachelor party in the middle of Kentucky, and then someone lets you in the Eagle or something like that. Probably not military. And all of a sudden, you're a bunch of 22-year-old white guys in the middle of Kentucky hanging out with a bunch of 50-year-old white guys in the middle of Kentucky, and things get awkward, and a midget shows up. Anyway.
The last thing I want to say about Defy Bloods, I want to stress how terrible Clark Peters' daughter is. as a character in the movie.
You cannot stress that enough.
Just this woman is 50 years old, approximately.
Who's the worst character? I think I know the answer. Who's the worst character? Her or the girlfriend of Omar Epps in Juice?
Oh, yes. She's an adult. She's like in her 30s. Yeah. Okay, I remember now.
She is a full adult that has had a divorce and might be a teacher.
Yeah, weird. I was just reminded of that. The character in Defy Bloods is worse by a wide margin because she has one line and is like the emotional redemption of a character.
It's pretty brutal.
Truly
it's
terrible. So bad. Truly, truly so terrible. Bad.
And she looks like she's 25.
Yeah, she's 50.
I didn't even think about that.
She's 50. She apparently still lives at home where her mom is doing very well for herself. Her mom, who is probably in her late 60s at best. Whatever. The character in Juice is pretty bad, but not as bad as that.
It's, yeah.
Please. Awful.
For a Wilmies, I think we got worse.
Awful. So terrible. That'll do us for our discussion on Defy Bloods. We talked for a really long time about a movie that I do think people should see, because there is so much there, and because this is a very weird movie year, and anything, you know, worth talking about should be taken in. But, yeah, all of us have our issues, some more intense than others.
Someone has a better grade for you.
By logarithmic levels.
What's the more interesting movie?
Selma. Selma's more interesting. I think Selma has more to say about about history and actual events.
What's the more interesting movie, Selma or The Five Bloods?
The Five Bloods, because Selma was, there was like no new information because of all the stuff I've read and, you know, just being a black person that stays up to date with the history of everything, like all of that, not new to me. So, for instance, you know, one of the things you said that was like kind of new to you or maybe something like that was that they were specifically trying to, they were at Selma because this dude was just a brutal piece of shit and was ready to beat everybody's ass. But he has letters where he says that, you know, but if you're, I guess just because I knew this, it was a less interesting movie to me. There was no new information presented to me. So for
that's interesting because I just watched Ken Burns' like 18-hour documentary about the Vietnam War a week before or so watching The Five Bloods. So I was similarly primed with a vast wealth of knowledge and expected some of it to either be supplemented by or informed The Five Bloods and was let down.
Right, but The Five Bloods is not a movie based on the history of something. Sure. It's not like a Selma almost could almost say it was a slightly dramatized documentary or whatever.
Sure.
You know, it's very dramatized, but like the Five Bloods, like you said, not a lot has to do with Vietnam in this. I mean, they have Vietnam things, but it's not a Vietnam War movie. It's a movie that, a movie that's trying to use the Vietnam War with a statement, but trying to use it as a vehicle for other things in the movie.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's fair. Our next trio is similarly themed. We recently, as a film community, of which the Media Community Club is an integral part, we recently lost Ennio Morricone, the legendary film composer, score composer, and we selected three movies, all of which contain Ennio Morricone scores, Sergio Leone's Once Upon a Time in the West, and John Carpenter's The Thing, and Brian De Palma's The Untouchables. So three movies with very strong reputations. We'll see if the Media Community Club co-signs on to those sterling legacies of critical acclaim.
Can't wait to shoot in The Untouchables.
Yeah, I've seen that movie.
I haven't seen any of these movies, so I'm excited.
Once Upon a Time in the West coming up first. That is available on Amazon Prime. The other two are available for rent from all the usual services. You can check out those reviews and more at MediaCommovie.club. You can like us on Facebook at MediaCommovieClub. Follow us on Twitter at MediaCommovieCol and Instagram at MediaCommovieClub. Thank you for joining me tonight, guys.
Thanks, John.
Thanks.
Have a good night.